Welcome to episode 3 of the Red Flags Rising podcast. My name is Mike Hunneke. I'm the co-chair of the Sanctions, Export Controls, and AML Practice Group at Hughes, Hubbard & Reed. With me, as always, is my good friend and director at the Berkeley Research Group, Brent Carlson. Brent, hello. How are you doing?
Great. Thanks, Mike. As always, it's great to be here and have a conversation with you on the important events of the day.
Sounds great, Brent. I'm looking forward to it. It is March 19th, 2025, just before 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern. Brent, I'm excited to start today with you. One line of podcasts that we'll be doing, amongst other things and other newsworthy developments, where we go back and look at a series of Fresh Looks posts that you started and that we continued on the NYU Law School's program on corporate compliance and enforcement blog. The PCCE has been a great friend and a great host to our work over the last several years. Given all of the events happening today, it's interesting and valuable to go back and look at some of these blog posts. We've covered everything from risk assessments, which answers the question, do I have a problem, all the way to, wait a second, I just got a visit from the Bureau of Industry and Security. What do I do about that? Brent, I'm excited today because we're going to talk about the first of the Fresh Looks blog posts, When Loopholes Create Liability Pitfalls, a Fresh Look at Export Controls. This was a piece that was published on August 25th, 2023. Eagle-eyed listeners who follow the links that we will put in the show notes will notice, Brent, that it's only your picture on this. That's because you are the father of this line of blog posts. Brent, I'm really interested, and I think our listeners would be interested too, and just hearing from you, how did this all come to pass? How did you come up with the idea for this article? What prompted you to write it?
Absolutely. This is an interesting story. And before getting into the story, let me present a little bit of context. So we've seen remarks from Secretary Lutnick at the BIS Update conference just yesterday. Secretary Lutnick is reiterating that an enforcement wave is coming with more actions and higher penalties. Also on April 1st, Secretary Lutnick, along with Secretary of State Rubio, have a joint report that's going to be due on how they're going to be closing loopholes in export controls. This takes us back to this article. If somebody's asking, well, how is BIS going to close these loopholes? Certain perceived loopholes are actually not loopholes, and they may be liability pitfalls. That was part of the inspiration for calling this a fresh look at export controls. Let's go back to first principles by taking a fresh look. Mike, I've seen export controls as an emerging issue that's been for a long time building up to a crescendo that we're seeing today. If we go back in time, I had a long history with business in China. I was there when it was opening up and multinationals were first investing there, saw the issues that they were facing. I could see issues around corruption when the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act started to become an issue. I could see that multinationals' operations in China were particularly vulnerable for FCPA exposure. And a lot of them were caught flat-footed when the government started to enforce the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act years ago. Now we fast forward to today, I could see the geopolitical winds changing. I could see in the first Trump administration that those trade tensions coming to the fore. Also, in the first Trump administration, we had the Export Control Reform Act that was passed as well. So there's already this thinking in Washington of how does the United States approach trade with China on a system-wide basis. Export controls is one. With my background doing investigations and helping folks with compliance issues, I could see export controls were an area of particular vulnerability in terms of how is the government going to enforce this and how are companies going to comply. If we look back in history with export controls, after the end of the Cold War between the United States and the Soviet Union, it was a very different environment. Even when the business in China was a very different environment, it was open. The assumption is we were moving to an integrated world without those geopolitical tensions. Now it's very different. And we could see this change coming in the first Trump administration, where the first Trump administration applied tariffs. On the export control side, we also see that's where we have the Export Control Reform Act. So there was a system-wide redesigns of approach to how the United States is going to look at export controls. With my background in doing investigations and compliance work, I could see that export controls were going to be a particular vulnerable part for companies in this new environment. As the regulation changes, as enforcement priorities change based on political dynamics, this is going to come to the fore. Now, the story that hit the news was a Chinese company called Inspur was put onto the entity list. And then media coverage reported that companies, these would be US companies supplying this particular Chinese company, Inspur, with products, were then shipping to subsidiaries of Inspur. And this was reported as a loophole. Those media reports then prompted a letter from the Select Committee on the Chinese Communist Party in the House of Representatives, a letter from Mike Gallagher, who was chair then, to then Commerce Secretary Raimondo, basically saying, "Hey, what's going on here? Why aren't you stepping up enforcement? Why aren't you even enforcing your own regulations?" That's prompted me to write this article because there's a disconnect in terms of what I could see happening within the compliance community. You'd have folks in that have who would have more of a white collar type background approach things very differently from others who had more of an administrative background. And you can see this bifurcation even in BIS itself. There's BIS administration, there's BIS enforcement. And the perspectives are a little bit different. That was the background. I looked at it and I said, "Well, wait a minute. Is this truly a loophole? A US company, a multinational, has a client in the PRC. That client goes on the entity list. Depending on the facts and circumstances around it, then if you have that shifts once they go on the entity list, they shift to a subsidiary. That's not necessarily a loophole. That can indicate an intent to circumvent or evade the export administration regulations."
And what I like about your analysis there, Brent, is you're looking at media reports. The media reports almost assume that there is some loophole, as in a legitimate gap in the regulations themselves. You second guessed that, or at least wanted to stress test that when you actually followed the path through the relevant provisions of the U.S. Export Administration regulations and Bureau of Industry and Security guidance, it struck you, if I'm understanding you correctly, that wait a second, this might not actually be a loophole at all, that this is actually a misperceived loophole. Instead of it being shame on the government for having gaps in its regulations, this might be a situation where shame on people who think they are benefiting from a loophole because they're going to expose themselves to enforcement risk.
That's absolutely correct. And it reflects what I noticed in going through the EAR was that, and in my experience talking with a lot of people out there, is that there's some selective viewing of the EAR without the context around it. I look back and I go, okay, where would companies be getting this idea that there's a particular loophole here? It's in the guidance. It's with that subsidiaries, parent companies, and sister companies are legally distinct from listed entities. Therefore, the licensing and other obligations imposed on a licensing entity by virtue of its being listed do not per se apply to its subsidiaries. Okay, that's clear. This goes back to a pattern, though, that we've noticed and discussed and talked about with folks where it's like, well, you got to look at what's above that passage and what's below that passage. And immediately, right below that paragraph, it says in this very same guidance, "If, however, such a company or even an unaffiliated company acts as an agent, affront, or shell company for the listed entity in order to facilitate transactions that would not otherwise be permissible with the listed entity, then the company is likely violating, inter alia, General Prohibition 10 in the EAR 764." So that, I thought that's very interesting. Let's unpack that, right? If you look at EAR 764.2, refers to knowledge.
Brent, just to put a pin on the comment you made about selective quotation from guidance and the dangers of that. We have seen that before. We talked about it on a recent pod in the context of guidance about your obligation to affirmatively investigate and look for red flags and where that exists and against what you're supposed to interrogate. It's very dangerous to cherry pick if the people making decisions don't appreciate the full context of the language that's being quoted to them. They might also inadvertently and without any malice or ill intent interpret the same guidance in a completely different way with a vastly different outcome. So it's anytime something sounds great or sounds even too good to be true, you need to trust but verify, and you need to look at the context and make sure that you're not engaging in conduct or starting down a path that the longer you're on it, the further and further and further away you're going to be from the expectations of the regulators.
That's absolutely correct. And one thing to highlight too is just because something hasn't been enforced in a particular way, it doesn't mean it won't be in the future. I mean, things work fine until they don't. Getting into the article, the next piece is the definition of knowledge in the EAR. And this is very important as well. BIS has been giving signals that it is going to be enforcing, using, and leveraging this high probability standard, where we see in the definition of knowledge, this is where we see another area where selective interpretation can lead to pitfalls. Knowledge includes not only positive knowledge, i.e. actual knowledge, but also an awareness of a high probability of its existence or future existence. Of course, people would say, I don't possess actual knowledge. But if you look at the facts and circumstances around a transaction and you look at, okay, how does this differ from what was going on before it? How does this differ from other normal course of business transactions? It will stand out like a sore thumb from a white collar enforcement perspective.
Brent, the whole discussion of knowledge was the real unlock for me. Given both of our experience in the world of Foreign Corrupt Practices Act enforcement, there's a prohibition on making direct bribe payments. There's also a separate offense, irrespective of that first one, that if you make a payment to a third party, being aware of a high probability that there's corruption involved, the government can convict you for that and that alone. Even if, for example, the agent steals your money, even if the bribe isn't sufficient, if you get out-bribed by somebody else, for example, unless you do risk-based due diligence to lower that probability to an acceptable level. You need to document that. You need to be able to explain that and show it if you're ever investigated or even audited for your compliance with that provision of the FCPA. Seeing this definition in the Export Administration Regulations for me was hugely significant. Now, I have to be honest, Brent. When I first got your article, and I got it because I had signed up for email alerts with the NYU PCCE blog, I hated it because I had just published an article in Westlaw that was much more boring, was much more poorly written. You're being kind now, but it made essentially the same point. And so my initial reaction was like, oh man, who is this guy on my corner? And I wrote a friend of mine. So you wrote your article, it was published on August 25th. I went back in my email, 4:25 p.m., August 25th, forwarded it to my friend, Yandu Nwajewicz, with whom I had co-authored the Westlaw piece. Good thing we got ours out before this guy's piece, which basically makes the same point, and then links to your article. And then I had, you know, my better angels prevailed, and the next day I connected with you on LinkedIn, just complimented you on the excellent piece. I'll be honest, it helped when I realized that you weren't working at another law firm and that you were working at a consulting group. That's, you know, really where a great partnership and friendship began. You know, that initial exchange and seeing the clear explanation of what people might be missing really started for us has been over a dozen, and it's ongoing, and it will continue articles with the NYU program on corporate compliance and enforcement blog, really with the purpose of taking this kernel, this key unlock that you have here in your first article, and then applying these concepts to everything along the compliance investigations waterfront. Do I have a risk? Well, let's talk about what this risk assessments, and that'll be an upcoming pod. We'll talk about that article. I think I may have a risk. I might have a problem. What do I do? How do you investigate it? Again, with the right mindset, with a clear-eyed view of what the knowledge definition is. And maybe to wrap up the discussion of the article itself, Brent, you also keyed in on the fact that people might be getting distracted by focusing too much on technical item classification. Can you ever not do that? No, that's not the point. But the point is, even if something's a paperclip and you're exporting it from the United States, there are end-use and end-user catch-all provisions. And what is unique about those, and what is interesting about those, to tie this back to your original article here, Brent, is that they include the knowledge element as defined in the Export Administration Regulations. So while there are some parts of the EAR that, in terms of awareness and knowledge of what's happening, they are strict liability in that area. So whether or not you knew, for example, the recipient of your product is on the entity list, they can still fine you. But for other areas, end use, end user, foreign direct product rule, a few others, knowledge is an element. That means that the government has to prove it, but it's false comfort to think that they have to prove actual knowledge. They only have to prove an awareness of a high probability, or if you read the full definition of knowledge, even a reason to know, which is more familiar to our friends who deal with OFAC sanctions evasion issues. But so, Brent, you really tied everything together in a way that I really appreciated, and it's been a springboard for taking this idea and applying it in practical ways across a variety of different issues that people dealing with trade compliance challenges face every day.
The initial reaction, be negative at first, I would say that you're not alone. The point here is not to pour cold water on anybody. The point here is to help. You know, the world has changed. What do we need to do to up our game to be responsive to it?
Brent, are these concerns still relevant in today's enforcement environment?
They are absolutely. In fact, they're more important than ever. Now, one thing I will say that is a little bit different. I was looking at this from the perspective of the DOJ stepping up its enforcement activity. We can see now that it's really flipped. It's BIS leading the charge. I wrote this from the perspective of issues potentially demonstrating intent, which would be that liability pitfall. With BIS stepping up its enforcement on civil actions, it doesn't need to wait for the DOJ. It doesn't need to prove intent from the criminal perspective. It can just go and take this high probability standard and go to town with it. BIS has very important, very powerful tools at its disposal to up its enforcement game as well.
And that's exactly how Secretary Lutnick concluded his remarks yesterday at the BIS update conference in Washington, D.C. Brent, what were your key takeaways for readers in this article? What do people need to take away from the article?
First is rethink your assumptions on export controls. Apply a fresh perspective, a white-collar enforcement perspective to the compliance program. That's the salt in the stew. You may have the components there, but it's like making stew. If you don't have the salt, it doesn't come together. This white-collar enforcement perspective is the salt in the stew that's going to tie that all together and help you to take the right steps to protect yourselves in this new environment and in this new world we live in. That will take you to the next part. Reevaluate your compliance program with this perspective. Start applying that high probability standard. Start with a risk assessment. Where are we potentially exposed by decisions that we have made that could come back and bite us that we need to kind of clean up? And how are we going to look at this going forward? How are we going to create a high probability protocol and then implement it throughout the compliance program? And the third part is really reassess business partner due diligence. That's another key area that is going to have to really change with the times. Going back to Mike Gallagher's letter from the China Committee to Commerce Secretary Raimondo, one of the things at the time was frustration. Why are these subsidiaries not on the entity list? Well, at the end of the day, they may not necessarily need to be on the entity list for there to be enforcement actions that are taken by BIS. It's important to keep that in mind. It's not just like, oh, my item's not on a list, so I'm fine. No, It takes a total new mindset in this new world.
And I think the asterisk on that point is that the flip side of this high probability enforcement playbook is that there's a high probability compliance playbook. You do not, and frankly cannot in real life, zero risk really anything, certainly not everything, especially if you're a major corporation involved in thousands or millions of transactions. So, Brent, thank you for writing the article. I think it was very important. It was super useful and remains super useful today. That brings us to a segment back yet again by popular demand, Brent Carlson's Managing Up. So, Brent, looking back at this article and its relevance still today, how can trade compliance professionals manage up based on this article?
It comes down to going back to first principles. So I would say it's the Boy Scout model, be prepared. Now's the time to be prepared because the world has changed. New things are coming. Get ready so you're not hit. The high probability standard can be used by companies, the compliance teams to protect themselves and their officers and directors from this new enforcement paradigm.
If there was any doubt, Brent, about where things are heading directionally in terms of enforcement, to the extent people were waiting to see what this administration was going to do and what it was going to say about its objectives and how it was going to achieve them, Secretary Lutnick left little doubt with his comments at the BIS update conference yesterday, which we covered in episode two of our podcast. Brent, that wraps up episode three. This was very awesome. I really appreciate your time. Always great to talk to you, and especially fun to go back and revisit the article that started the whole Fresh Looks series. Be well, my friend.
Be well. Thank you.